This is Audible.
For additional materials, please see the PDF that accompanies this program. TED Books and Simon & Schuster Audio present How to Fix a Broken Heart by Dr. Guy Winch. Read by the author.
Author's note. In this book, I use numerous case studies from my private practice. When doing so, I have made efforts to disguise any identifying information. Consequently, the names of my patients, as well as those of their significant others, both human and animal, have been changed. I have also tried to back up my assertions with empirical scientific studies published in top-notch scientific journals with blind peer review acceptance procedures. Introduction. The storm of heartbreak strikes like a hurricane. At times, we are alerted to its arrival by an early forecast of ominous signs. Often, it catches us by surprise. A conversation that takes a startling turn, or an unexpected text as we busily go about our day. Either way, when the storm touches down, it lands hard. The wind batters our sense of security and certainty. The icy rain soaks every nook and cranny of our being, from the part of us that is a capable professional to the part that's a devoted parent or a passionate artist or a weekend partier. We squint at the world through glasses tinted by emotional pain, fearing the dark clouds will never break. Unlike real hurricanes, heartbreak has no eye. It offers no reprieve, and it leaves no place to take shelter. We thus remain exposed, drenched, and miserable until it passes. These feelings and perceptions are familiar to most. Virtually every one of us has or will have our heart broken at some point in our lives, whether by romantic love or by loss. Given how ubiquitous heartbreak is, it is remarkable that we know so little about how to heal it. Even more remarkable, given how personally familiar we are with the emotional devastation it causes, is that our societal attitudes toward heartbreak are so downright dismissive. We tend to associate having a broken heart with something that happens to the young, the naive or the inexperienced, teenagers and young adults who have not yet felt the full weight of adult responsibilities on their shoulders. Real adults are supposed to handle such occurrences as they might any other setback or disappointment, with maturity and stoicism. Heartbreak resides firmly in the category of baseball and spilled milk. It is simply not something one cries over, or so we believe. That is, until our own heart gets broken. For then, we will swiftly be reminded that heartbreak hurts just as much later in life as it did when we were teenagers. It evokes just as much paralyzing emotional pain, and it impairs our thinking and functioning in all the same ways. We will also have to confront the unfortunate reality that, unlike with our teenage experiences we had received in high school, the understanding, support, and compassion are likely to be noticeably absent. Mirroring the lack of seriousness with which we regard it, the term heartbreak has itself become diluted. We declare ourselves heartbroken when our favorite sports team loses an important game, when the crystal vase we inherited from our grandmother slips out of our hands and shatters on the floor, or when we discover the heroine in our favorite novel fails to choose the supernatural teen suitor we hoped she would. As disappointing and upsetting as such events are, none of us would confuse them with the anguish we feel when our hearts are truly broken. Real heartbreak is unmistakable, from the intensity of the emotional pain it causes to the totality with which it takes over our mind and even our body. We think of nothing else. We feel nothing else. We care about nothing else. And often, we feel as if we can do nothing else except sit with the immense pain, grief, and loss. Broken hearts come in many forms, but in this book, I have chosen to focus on two types of heartbreak that have much in common: romantic heartbreak and the heartbreak that ensues from the loss of a cherished pet. I have done so because these experiences involve a complication that is particularly difficult for the broken-hearted. They are accompanied by severe grief responses, yet they are not deemed as important by society as, let's say, a formal divorce or the loss of a first-degree relative. As a result, we are often deprived of the recognition, support, and compassion afforded those whose heartbreak is considered significant. Indeed, when a parent, child, or sibling dies, we are likely to get an outpouring of support and compassion from institutions as well as from individuals. Employers will offer us condolences, understanding, and bereavement leave when our parent dies. But they will do no such thing when our beloved dog dies, even though for some people, the latter is just as profound, if not more. Similarly, our boss is likely to be much more understanding of our lackluster performance once we explained we are going through a divorce than if we confess to mourning the loss of a short-term relationship, however intense and important. Further complicating matters, the lack of empathy we receive from others is often reflected in our own attitudes. Too many of us ache with emotional pain, only to then criticize ourselves for hurting. We falsely believe we should somehow stay calm and carry on, that we should be able to function normally, when psychologically speaking, something very abnormal is going on. Now, new scientific studies are confirming what many of us already suspected. Heartbreak impacts our brain and our behavior in dramatic and unexpected ways, and that it does so regardless of our age. One of the most unfortunate realities of heartbreak is that our natural responses often do us more harm than good. Many of the behaviors and habits we typically adopt to cope with heartache are likely to deepen our emotional pain, delay our recovery, and even damage our long-term mental health. Sadly, most of us have no idea what these behaviors are, how we might avoid them, or how we might break free of them once they are already ingrained. This same body of research has also illuminated effective techniques we could use to accelerate our healing. Most of us do not know what those are either. As a psychologist who has had a private practice for over 2 decades, I have had a front row seat, or rather armchair, to hundreds of heartbroken people and their struggle to heal and recover. Since my office is in the melting pot of New York City, my patients come from all over the world and have a range of ages, gender identities, and ethnic and cultural backgrounds. And yet I learned early on that when it comes to heartbreak, these kinds of demographic factors matter not a whit. Cultural differences might influence how we react to heartbreak outwardly, but what we feel inside, the pain and anguish we experience internally, is very much the same. As most psychologists, I entered the field because I was motivated to ease the emotional and mental suffering of others. Looking back at the most dramatic and painful moments I've witnessed in my career, heartbreak was responsible for a majority of them. Yet graduate school taught me very little, if anything, about how to fix a broken heart. So I turned to academic journals for enlightenment and advice. Researchers have been studying heartbreak for years, and their findings, albeit often written in dry and academic terms, have offered many insights and techniques that have helped my heartbroken patients recover more quickly. I present the best of them here, along with the stories of the patients who needed them, their unrecognized struggles, and the journey of healing on which we embarked together. This book is an effort to bring heartbreak out of the shadows, first so we recognize its devastating impact on people of every age, and second, so we have effective tools for self-healing. If your heart is broken, it will definitely take time to heal. But as you'll soon discover, How much time is now up to you. Chapter 1. How the Broken-Hearted Are Abandoned. In my years as a clinical psychologist, I have worked with hundreds of people whose heart was broken by love or loss. Anyone who has experienced a broken heart, and that is most of us, probably remembers the feeling well. The shock, the haze of unreality that makes us feel as though we must be in an alternate universe, and how disconnected we feel when we see those around us go about their lives as if nothing has happened, oblivious to the earthquake of emotional devastation that has shattered our world. But by far, the most pronounced aspect of heartbreak is the paralyzing emotional pain it causes. Indeed, our very understanding of what it means to have a broken heart is so tightly bound to the incredible anguish it causes, the two are practically synonymous. In many ways, they should be, as the story of heartbreak is a tale of emotional pain, our responses to that pain, and our efforts to recover from it. When a patient's heart gets broken, my heart always aches alongside theirs. The training and defense mechanisms that typically shield me in my daily work often fail in the face of such raw emotional agony. Perhaps I allow my defenses to fail. My way of letting the grief-stricken person before me know that I see their pain, I feel it. Because, unfortunately, many people in their lives do not. Our journey through heartbreak is determined by multiple variables. The specific nature of the relationship or loss, our fundamental character and coping styles, our individual and family histories, the current context of our lives, and how we manage or mismanage our recovery. The last crucial variable that impacts our recovery is also the one most likely to disappoint us, our available support systems, friends and family, communities, schools, and places of employment. How support systems fail the heartbroken. Support systems typically play a pivotal role in recovery from loss. Consider what happens when we lose a first-degree relative. The outpouring of concern around us provides emotional validation, reassuring us the emotional pain we feel is a normative and reasonable response to our loss. Friends and family offer compassion and empathy, as well as both literal and metaphorical shoulders to cry on. Neighbors and community members bring us food and encourage us to eat if we are in too much anguish to register hunger. Our workplaces offer us time off to grieve and receive the support we need, and many also offer counseling services to aid our recovery. However, when our heartbreak is caused by a romantic breakup or by the loss of a beloved pet, which are not considered sanctioned forms of grief, our support systems are likely to respond very differently. As we shall see, this lack of support impacts us in significant ways. Not only are we robbed of an essential curative ingredient, we are often faced with additional stresses that compound our suffering, increase our emotional distress, and complicate our recovery. What makes this lack of support even more impactful is that we don't exactly have a quiver full of therapeutic arrows to deploy when our heart is broken. We have been experiencing broken hearts for millennia, and yet most of us know of only two healing agents, social support and time. Losing the former leaves us with only time as a remedy, a variable over which we have no control whatsoever, which is why heartbreak often makes us feel so helpless. This is also why so few of us seek the counsel of a therapist when our heart gets broken. We assume the only significant thing a therapist could offer in such situations is support, and most of us hope to receive that from our friends and loved ones, at least initially. Therefore, it should not be surprising that the vast majority of my heartbroken patients came to therapy to discuss other issues entirely, dating and relationships often among them. and their heart happened to get broken during treatment. The patients we will meet in the coming chapters represent a variety of heartbreaks and circumstances. Their stories reflect the various ways we are impacted when a heart gets broken, the mistakes we make that set us back, the roles our support networks play, and the different roads we can take to recovery. Heartbreak is painful enough when there are signs of its impending arrival, when it comes upon us slowly. But when it assaults us suddenly and unexpectedly, it can be as shocking as it is devastating. Therefore, when I see heartbreak coming from miles away, I always sound a warning. Some of my patients heed these warnings. Many do not. Such is the lure of hope and need when infatuation teases our heart with the promise of deeper love. And then, every once in a while, I am as blindsided by the heartbreak that befalls my patients as they are. Kathy was in her late 20s when she first began psychotherapy for issues that had nothing to do with heartbreak. Raised in a small town in the Midwest, she had moved to New York for graduate school, fell in love with the city, and decided to stay. An excellent student, she had no trouble landing a corporate position as soon as she graduated. When I met Kathy for our first session, she was well-groomed and well-dressed in a crisp pantsuit and heels. With poise and confidence that matched her firm handshake, she sat forward on the couch, legs folded and hands on her lap, showing no signs of nervousness about having to tell a complete stranger her life story, or highlights thereof. I was still settling into my seat when she smiled and said in a rich, smooth voice, "Shall I tell you why I'm here?" Kathy's body language conveyed patience and self-control, yet she was clearly eager to get down to business. "Please do," I said with a smile. Kathy took a deep breath and began. "I was that girl who plans her entire life in middle school, wedding scrapbook and all." She ticked the steps off on her fingers. "I'd go to college, then graduate school, land a good job, and start dating my future husband by age 27, 28 at the latest. We'd move in together after a year, get engaged a year after that, and marry before I was 30. The obvious distress on Kathy's face told me her life had not gone as planned. "I did college, finished graduate school, and got a good job," she continued. "But when it came time to find my future husband, what I found instead was a lump in my breast." Given her youth and excellent overall health, Kathy's doctors suggested she get the strongest chemotherapy possible, and Kathy agreed. "They told me the side effects would be bad," Kathy went on, "and they were. I could deal with the hair loss, the terrible nausea, the sores in my mouth, but I had intense nerve pain all over my body." Kathy shuddered at the recollection. It was excruciating. She took a breath and composed herself before continuing. "My friends and family were amazing. They totally got me through it." Fortunately, Kathy's chemotherapy was successful. Eager to get back to her life plan, she turned her efforts toward recovering. She ate healthy foods and worked out as much as her stamina allowed. Her body slowly regained strength. Her hair grew back, and she eventually felt ready to venture back into the dating world. Over the course of her treatment and recovery, many of Kathy's friends had gotten engaged, and she found herself attending bachelorette parties or weddings almost every month. Tired of attending them alone, she decided to take action. "I sent my friends a group text with two words. 'I'm ready,'" Kathy said, smiling. "Within days, I had blind dates coming at me from every direction. I literally caught myself walking around humming 'It's Raining Men.' My life was finally getting back on track. I felt happy for the first time in almost 2 years." Kathy sighed heavily, and her eyes welled with tears. "And then, last month, I found a lump in my other breast." She dabbed at her eyes as her tears fell. That's why I'm here. The thought of having to do it all over again is just horrible. I'm going to need help getting through it. Kathy had already endured more than most, and now she would have to endure even more. That someone so young had to go through so much seemed truly unfair. What heartened me was Kathy's incredible emotional strength. Despite facing her second battle with cancer in 2 years, she had not lost hope or stopped fighting. Indeed, her response was both wise and psychologically healthy. She was reaching out to a therapist to shore up her support system in anticipation of the struggle ahead. For the next year, I witnessed Kathy fight cancer with determination, dignity, and strength. The side effects of the second chemotherapy were just as challenging as the first, but she never considered stopping the treatment. She simply set her sights on the goalpost of remission and never wavered. I was thrilled to learn that Kathy's resolve had again paid off, as her second treatment was also effective and she was once again in remission. This time, it took her body longer to recover, but eventually, she got stronger. Her hair grew back. Her scars healed. And the day again came when she sent an "I'm ready" text to her wonderful circle of supportive friends. "And it began raining men again," Kathy said in our session. "Hallelujah," I responded, quoting the next line of the song. A few months later, Kathy met Rich, a stock analyst in his mid-30s, and fell in love. Rich seemed to be exactly the kind of man Kathy needed, gentle, considerate, and affirming. He complimented her, he kissed her scars, and let her know how attracted he was to her, and he took her to romantic restaurants and on spontaneous weekend getaways to the beach. Kathy had never been happier. 6 months after they started dating, Kathy came into my office beaming. "Good news!" I tried to hide my excitement. Rich had just taken Kathy to a romantic bed and breakfast in New England. It was fall, and the foliage was at its peak. It was the perfect time and place for a proposal. "Yes?" I asked as casually as I could. Kathy took a deep breath and announced, "I started a Pinterest page." "That's great," I said, forcing a smile. "Oh, you thought, but that's actually the point. He didn't ask me yet, but after the great weekend we had, it feels like he will any day now. So I went to my parents' house and got my old wedding scrapbook. I scanned it in and started a wedding Pinterest page." This time, my smile was authentic. 2 weeks later, Rich nervously asked Kathy to dinner in their favorite spot, a quiet, romantic restaurant with private booths and low lighting. After their drinks arrived, he took her hand and broke up with her. Rich explained that although he cared about Kathy tremendously and loved spending time with her, his feelings simply hadn't progressed the way hers had. Since he felt sure she was not the one, he thought it was only fair to let her know. Kathy was devastated. Once again, her friends and family rallied around her in her hour of need. And her need was great. I thought I had seen Kathy at her most despondent, but her anguish was profound. She cried for weeks. She barely functioned at work, and she spent hours sitting in the dark, paralyzed by emotional pain. She frequently missed sessions, and despite my urging, was unable to get herself to therapy more than once a month. The breakup was all Kathy could talk about, both with me and with her friends. But while my sessions with her were few and far between, Kathy's friends racked up countless hours providing support, solace, and advice. After several months, they began exhibiting signs of impatience with Kathy's inability to move on. By the time I saw Kathy a month later, their impatience had turned to obvious frustration. Saddened as I was to hear about her friends losing patience, I was not surprised. I had seen this happen countless times. When our heart is broken, what determines others' compassion is not how much emotional pain we actually feel, but how much emotional pain they believe we should feel. Kathy had exceeded her friend's unspoken statute of limitations for mourning the relationship, and their empathy and support were rapidly evaporating as a result. In its place, Kathy was met with impatience, irritability, and even resentment. Before we judge Kathy's friends too harshly, it is important to consider that many of us have probably been guilty of similar judgments when our friends or loved ones' broken hearts took longer to mend than our subjective standards allotted, whether we expressed our impatience with them or not. Being around someone we care about when they are in sharp pain of any kind is a fundamentally distressing experience. In order to provide them with support and compassion, we have to first contain these unpleasant feelings within ourselves, or we will be too preoccupied with our own emotional reactions to focus on theirs. We do so with a tacit assumption that the efforts required to tolerate our own distress in order to be there for them will be met by commensurate efforts on their part to heal and move on. When we see their recovery stall, we assume, unconsciously, that they failed to live up to their part of the bargain, and so we feel less compelled to live up to ours. Thus, our empathy fades, and resentment rears its head. Unfortunately, our friends and loved ones are not the only people who can lose patience and compassion when our recovery stalls. One of the damaging ripple effects of losing social support is that we often internalize the impatience of those around us and lose self-compassion as well. We are then left with a double whammy of a massive reduction in social support and a massive increase in self-criticism. "My friends are right," Kathy sighed in that same session. "I should have moved on months ago, but I can't. Not without knowing why this happened. I still love him. I still miss him. I wish I didn't, but I just do." Kathy had been through two extremely harsh cancer treatments and never lost hope or motivation. In fact, she had displayed incredible emotional strength throughout the 4 years of her medical ordeal. But something was preventing her from marshaling her considerable internal strength and determination in order to heal her broken heart. And now, after losing her friend's support, I worried her recovery might stall completely. One thing Kathy said made me curious. "Not without knowing why this happened." After all, Rich had explained his reasons for breaking up. He cared for her deeply, but he simply wasn't in love. Apparently, Kathy had rejected his explanation, despite how reasonable it was, and had become convinced there was something he was not telling her, and obsessed with figuring out what it was. I asked her whether she discussed this issue with her friends. "That's pretty much all I discussed with them," she responded. I now began to understand why her friends had lost patience. Creating mysteries and conspiracies where none exist is a common response to romantic breakups. Our mind unconsciously assumes that if the emotional pain we feel is so dramatic, it must have an equally dramatic cause, even when it does not. Her friends probably took Rich's explanation at face value, and therefore perceived Kathy's insistence on finding alternative explanations as an unnecessary wild goose chase. In other words, they probably felt that by rejecting Rich's reasons for the breakup and pursuing alternate explanations, she was preventing herself from moving on, and it was that which caused them to lose empathy and compassion. Indeed, one of the biggest mistakes we tend to make when a heart gets broken is we overtax our support systems by voicing aloud all our internal ruminations about what went wrong. Doing so in the initial aftermath of a breakup is understandable. But when we keep repeating the same questions over and over for weeks and months at a time. Why wasn't I good enough? What went wrong? Why did they lie to me? Why did they stop loving me? While reaching no new insights, and without acknowledging those that have already been reached, even our strongest supporters can become frustrated. Therefore, despite how much we may be hurting, we have to keep our eye on whether we are overburdening our support systems and making efforts to provide breaks for those doing the lion's share of emotional support. To be clear, I am not advocating that we forego the emotional validation and compassion we still need. As I explained to Kathy when she told me about her friends losing compassion, you can still get support from them, but in a different way. After all, they still love you and care for you, even if their patience seems thin at the moment. I'm pretty sure that if you talk about other things for a short while, they will still know you're hurting, and they will demonstrate their caring with a hug, a look, or a squeeze of the hand. You just have to be open to accepting their support in the ways they are currently able to give it. As we shall see later on, Kathy heard my concerns and understood them, and she even made changes that allowed the tensions with her friends to ease. However, she still could not accept Rich's explanation for the breakup, and she still felt a powerful drive to unravel his true reasons. Still heartbroken, and feeling more alone than she had previously, she truly missed the unequivocal support her friends had provided. Our support networks play a significant role in our recovery from a broken heart. As such, their absence can be just as damaging when our heartbreak is due to the death of a beloved pet. Losing best friends and longtime companions. Ben was a writer for a large corporation who came to see me in his mid-40s after both his parents had died within 6 months of each other. Ben had divorced in his late 30s, had no children, and a limited number of friends. His parents were the only family Ben had left, and he struggled after their death. He had difficulty completing assignments on time and felt himself slipping into a depression. A human resources manager at his company intervened and suggested Ben consider psychotherapy. He came to see me soon thereafter. I worked with Ben for a few months. He took therapy seriously and was able to move through the roughest stages of the grieving process and get to a better place emotionally. It was at that point he decided to take a break from therapy, given that both his mood and his functioning at work had improved. I supported his decision. Ben promised to be in touch if he felt the need, and I reassured him he could contact me whenever he wanted. 7 years passed. Then one bright spring morning, I received an email from him. "I need to see you again, but you're going to think it's silly because it's about Bova. I know it's ridiculous to go to therapy to talk about a dog, but he's really sick and I need to talk about it. I know it sounds stupid and I feel embarrassed to ask, but please let me know if it's okay to make an appointment ASAP. My heart pinched as I read Ben's words. I remembered both him and Bova well. Ben worked from home and was alone in his apartment all day, so he had decided to get a dog for companionship soon after his divorce. He adopted a rescue pup he named Bova, an adorable Labrador and Golden Retriever mix. Bova was Ben's first dog, and he was totally smitten with him from day one. He devoted hours to playing with his new puppy and training him to do simple tricks. He proudly walked him around the neighborhood, and Bova, who was a ham even by dog standards, accrued fans and admirers everywhere. Even people who knew Ben previously began referring to him as Bova's dad. When Ben's parents first got sick, Ben took Bova with him whenever he visited them, just to be able to have Bova with him on the drive back and forth. When they were hospitalized, he asked their neighbors to watch Bova while he spent hours at their bedside. Ben also received support from his boss, who was considerate and understanding. He gave Ben time off to care for his parents as their conditions worsened, and to grieve for them when they died. I would like to think therapy was the vital ingredient that helped Ben get through his parents' death, But it was not. What truly kept him going during that dark period was Bova. "He sleeps with me in the bed at night," Ben told me in our first session. "He sits by me when I work. Yesterday I was watching TV and thinking about my dad, and I guess I started to cry. I didn't even notice I had tears on my cheek until Bova came over and began licking my hand. I swear he can tell when I'm sad. He's the most amazing dog." Bova was. Ben would often bring him to our sessions, where he would lie at the foot of the couch, his head resting on Ben's foot, truly attuned to Ben's mood and emotional distress. When Ben teared up or cried, Bova would sit up and lick his hand, or rest his head on Ben's knee. The bond between them was powerful and undeniable. With Bova's health failing, I could only imagine how distraught Ben must be. I met with Ben the next day. He came alone. Almost 15 years old now, Bova was deaf and almost entirely blind, and he often became anxious and restless in unfamiliar places. Since I had moved offices since I last saw Ben, he thought it best to leave Bova at home. Ben was extremely upset during our session, and I comforted him as best I could. We set up another time to meet the following week. But Bova's health deteriorated rapidly, and Ben had to take him to the vet the next day. Bova rallied at first, but then declined again a few days later. The vet determined he required surgery. Ben had already used his personal days and most of his vacation days to care for Bova over multiple health emergencies and vet visits. He used his last vacation day to stay by Bova's side as he recovered at home after the surgery. The next morning, Bova slipped into a coma. Out of both personal and vacation days, Ben called in sick to work so he could rush Bova back to the vet. His boss called him on his cell phone a few hours later after Ben didn't answer his landline. Ben admitted he was at the veterinary hospital and explained that his dog was very sick. His boss was furious. He insisted Ben get back to work immediately so he could meet an important deadline. Ben had no choice. He left Bova at the veterinary hospital and went home to finish his work. That afternoon, the vet called. Bova was failing rapidly. Ignoring the consequences of leaving his assignment incomplete, Ben rushed to his dog's side. When he arrived at the vet's, Bova was unconscious and breathing shallowly. Ben reached over and softly stroked his dog's head, tears streaking down his cheeks. "And then something amazing happened," Ben told me when we met the following evening. "Bova's eyes never opened when I touched him. So I put my hand near his nose so he could smell that it was me, and he licked my hand." Ben collapsed into sobs. "He knew I was crying, and he licked my hand, just like he always did. He licked my hand, and then he died." Although I often feel deeply sad when working with a patient whose heart is broken, I am rarely moved to tears. But Ben's description of Bova's last moments had me lunging for the tissue box. The enormity of Ben's loss was apparent. Bova's faithful companionship had eased Ben's loneliness after his divorce. His loyal devotion had comforted Ben when his parents died, and his playful and exuberant presence had been Ben's emotional anchor for the past 15 years. Ben's heart was absolutely shattered. But he was given no time to grieve. His boss called Ben into the office the next morning and put him on official warning for absenteeism. When Ben tried to explain what Bova had meant to him, his boss rolled his eyes and exclaimed, "It's just an animal! Get over it!" Ben tried to negotiate and asked to take a few days off without pay. His boss exploded, "Grow up, Ben! My 6-year-old had to flush her goldfish down the toilet last week. You think she got a week off school to cry in the dark?" Fortunately, I was able to intervene and write Ben a medical note that excused him from work for a couple of days. Ben's human resources department had no choice but to accept my note, but his boss openly voiced his disapproval. Upon his return, he assigned Ben a heavier-than-normal workload with ruthless deadlines. The threat of losing his job looming over him, Ben had no choice but to work through his tears. His inexcusable lack of compassion notwithstanding, Ben's boss is by no means an aberration. Our institutions rarely recognized how significant and traumatic it can be to lose a cherished pet, and they rarely afford those who experience such loss the compassion and understanding they desperately need. This lack of recognition makes an already painful grieving process even more difficult and complicated than it otherwise would be. To be clear, individuals, bosses as well, often respond with empathy and understanding to those whose heart is broken by romantic love or the death of a beloved pet. It is society as a whole that ignores the severity of emotional pain such losses evoke, and the profound impact they have on our functioning. Expecting Ben to be productive at work when his dog is dying in the animal hospital is naive, bordering on foolish. Ben's boss forced him to sit at his desk, but he was there in body only. His mind was with Bova. What is even more unfortunate is that too many of us internalize these kinds of insensitive, ignorant, and uninformed expectations and judge ourselves by them, despite how profoundly they contradict our emotional experience. Ben's initial email to me is a good illustration of this contradiction. Its tone was extremely tentative and apologetic, not only because Ben was worried I would consider his emotional distress illegitimate, but because he himself felt embarrassed by it. Adding layers of embarrassment or shame to the intense emotional distress we feel when our pet dies only exacerbates our heartache and complicates our recovery. That was why I allowed myself to display how sad I was when Ben told me about Bova dying. It was important for him to see me shedding a tear, something I had never done when his parents died, so I could validate how natural and legitimate it was for him to feel so heartbroken. In order to balance the total dismissiveness with which Ben's boss continued to treat his grief, I made sure to allow my feelings of empathy and compassion to register clearly on my face and in my voice as the weeks progressed. It took many months for Ben to recover from Bova's death, far longer than it had taken him to recover when his parents died. In part, this was because Ben's parents had not been an integral part of his daily life. They were not strongly associated with the many experiences and situations that comprised Ben's personal and social activities, whereas Bova was. In addition, there was no doubt in my mind that Ben's inability to express his grief at work and the total lack of compassion his boss demonstrated for his emotional pain made his recovery significantly more challenging. When our heart is broken, and our institutions deny us the support and understanding we deserve, it is important for us to reject their dismissive message and actively seek to have our feelings validated elsewhere in whatever way we can. There are more options to do so than we realize. Since Ben had no family and so few friends, I tried to fill that void as best I could over the months that followed. I also suggested Ben join a support group for people who have lost pets. The fact that such groups are sprouting up all over is yet another indication of the lack of societal recognition people who lose their pets are afforded. I encouraged Ben to reach out to a man he knew from a dog run he visited with Bova, who had recently lost his dog as well. Bova had been Ben's loyal friend for 15 years, and he was associated with every facet of Ben's life. Generally speaking, when our heart is broken, the more substantial our relationship and our connection are, whether with a pet or the object of our romantic affections, the deeper our grief is likely to be and the longer it might take us to recover. What makes heartbreak so different from other forms of grief is that sometimes even the loss of a brief and superficial connection can pierce our core to the depths. The dating minefield is littered with broken hearts. Lauren, the 27-year-old daughter of an actuary and an engineer, came to therapy to work on her cripplingly low self-esteem and significant social anxiety. A medical student, who was far more comfortable with thought and logic than with emotions, hers and others, she usually preferred the company of textbooks and petri dishes to that of people. Her sexual experience amounted to little more than a few alcohol-infused make-out sessions in college, and her current dating life was non-existent. As is the case with many who suffer from social anxiety, years of fear and avoidance had warped some of her perceptions and fostered highly self-critical and overly pessimistic beliefs about both her worth and her chances of success in the dating world. As is the case with many who have very low self-esteem, she perceived herself to be significantly less attractive, both physically and personality-wise, than she actually was. Our initial work consisted of me enlisting Lauren's penchant for reason to challenge some of her distorted assumptions about her looks and her social desirability in order to create a more conducive mindset for working on her self-esteem. A few months into therapy, Lauren had made enough progress that a friend was finally able to persuade her to join a popular dating site. A week later, Lauren announced she had just scheduled her first date since college. "My friend has been swiping left and right for years," she said. "She told me it's typical to have more bad first dates than good, so I guess the key is to try to have fun, but keep my hopes moderate." I was glad to hear Lauren was keeping her expectations low. She had not been on a formal date in years, and her dating skills were likely to be rusty at best. I suggested she think of her first few dates as practice, with a goal of getting more comfortable with the dating scene. If something comes of them, great, but it might take her a bit to get the swing of things. Rejection and disappointment are such an inherent part of the dating experience that by reinforcing Lauren's moderate expectations, I hope they would not impact her as severely as they might otherwise. The next day, Lauren left me an excited message, eager to share how much she had enjoyed her date. Apparently, she and her date had several drinks and talked for over 3 hours. She was absolutely thrilled. Our next session was 2 days later. Lauren never showed up. She left me a message that night, apologizing and explaining she was too distraught to come to therapy. I found out what happened only later. Lauren hadn't heard from her date for 2 days, so she texted him and expressed interest in seeing him again. When he responded several hours later, he sent her a terse text saying he had enjoyed the date as well, but wasn't interested in seeing her again. "I literally spent 3 days crying in bed," Lauren explained when we met next, the hurt still apparent on her face. "I missed school and my rotations. It was terrible. I was a mess. The only thing worse than how broken I felt was how humiliated I felt about feeling so broken. Everyone warned me to be cautious and keep my hopes in check, and I did. I really did. I went to the date expecting so little, and then I fell to pieces anyway. What's wrong with me? Why did I feel so heartbroken after only one date?" We tend to associate romantic heartbreak with substantial and meaningful loss. So why did Lauren feel so heartbroken after a single date? And why did the apex of the emotional pain she felt last for 3 whole days when her expectations had been so moderate to begin with? The answer to the first question involves a common mistake many of us make when we enter or re-enter the dating world. Lauren knew it was important to keep her hopes moderate and protect her self-esteem, and she was careful to set low expectations before she went on her date, but she neglected to keep her expectations low after it. Once the date went well, Lauren's expectations quickly soared, setting her up for a much bigger blow. As to the second question, what kept Lauren housebound for 3 full days was not the initial blow of the rejection, but the shame and isolation that came thereafter. She was so convinced her friends, and me, would consider her heartbreak to be ridiculous and inappropriate that she was afraid to reach out to the very people who could have provided her comfort and support. Her self-imposed isolation, the ridicule she imagined facing when she told her friends how devastated she felt, and the ensuing lack of emotional validation, support, and empathy, significantly prolonged her suffering. Lauren is by no means an anomaly. I have worked with scores of people whose hearts got broken after a single date, something which is especially common for those who re-enter the dating world after not having been in it for a long period of time, whether they were single or in long-term relationships. While this kind of heartbreak is usually short-lived, it can be incredibly intense and painful nonetheless. Unfortunately, in almost every case, they felt the very same shame and embarrassment Lauren did, and having those feelings significantly added to the emotional pain and distress they felt and made them extremely hesitant to set up any other dates. That certain types of heartbreak are disenfranchised in society makes healing a broken heart difficult enough. We certainly should not add to the injustice by disenfranchising our own emotional pain. The worst thing we could do for ourselves when we are hurting is to internalize these arbitrary standards, become self-critical as a result, and deny ourselves the very empathy and support we so badly need. Kathy's heart was broken when the man she dated for 6 months and expected to marry broke up with her. Ben's heartbreak was a result of losing a beloved pet that had been a hugely significant part of his life for 15 years, and Lauren had her heart broken after a single date. While they each faced separate hurdles on their road to recovery, one hurdle they should not have had to deal with was the withdrawal or absence of support and validation from the people and institutions around them. There is a reason most cultures have mourning rituals that involve the larger community. When we are grieving, we need empathy, we need compassion, we need hugs. Grief researchers have long acknowledged that heartbreak is a form of grief. Our communities, our societies, and many of the people in them do not. Until, of course, they are the ones who are heartbroken. But why do we consider heartbreak so unworthy of the same concern and respect as other forms of grief? One of the main reasons society trivializes certain types of heartbreak is that we do not fully comprehend the extent to which our mind, our body, and especially our brain are impacted when our heart is broken. But now, after decades of study, scientists know much more than we used to about the phenomenon of heartbreak. The findings of the studies we'll explore in the pages to come have taken much of the mystery out of the unconscious and unseen processes that take place in our brain and body when our heart is broken. Understanding exactly what happens to us when we are heartbroken is an essential step in being able to heal and move on. Chapter 2. When hearts break, brains and bodies break too. Heartbreak is a hijacker. The emotional anguish it causes invades our thoughts, captures our attention, seizes our focus, and dominates our awareness. Like a black hole that pulls everything toward it, all we see and do is now experienced in reference to our broken heart, viewed through the lens of our loss. The emotional pain is so inescapable, and the tightness in our chest so real, it feels as though our heart is literally broken. This metaphor of a broken heart, combined with the fact that it was caused by a single loss, makes us perceive heartbreak as a discrete and specific injury, as if there is one simple thing wrong with us. But heartbreak is neither a simple injury nor a specific one. It is systemic and complex. Heartbreak impacts far more than our mind and emotions. It affects our body, our brain, our functioning, and our relationships, and it does so in far-reaching and surprising ways. Our oversimplified view of heartbreak is more consequential than we realize.